Hi, my name's Charlie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Tim for asking me to come up here and participate in this meeting and to spend the weekend up here. He and his wife, Renee, have been really gracious hosts, and I've enjoyed myself. And it's a short drive, which is nice, and you can do. I'm used to going to the Dry Riverbed group out in some of the farther reaches of Los Angeles, so this is really nice to come to Santa Barbara and relax and be up here in the mountains and try to pretend I'm spiritual. And this is great, and to see so many alcoholics awake at this hour of the morning is since Sunday is a day that we all remember. I don't remember many Tuesdays or Wednesdays. I never really considered those, but Sunday for me was the most hideous day of the week, and it happened over and over again. It just seemed like it was Sunday to Sunday, and it's great to be up and aware and healthy and sober. In 3 weeks, if I'm lucky, I'll have 13 years of sobriety, and I'm really most grateful for that. It's not as much as many people in Alcoholics Anonymous have, but it's more than most get, not because of anything great that I have done, but because of the nature of alcoholism, that most of us don't make it, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the most successful sobriety program in history, and still, because of the tenacity of alcoholism, we struggle to stay sober, even with all the help that we can get here. And it's really a privilege to be able to be a participant in something like this, to have commitments in AA, and to be amongst you, because otherwise I don't think I would be sober. If I was sober on pure disposition and willpower, I wouldn't make it. You know, I couldn't make it 2 weeks, because my disposition is to get drunk just to show you. And I don't choose to do that these days, because I'd have to answer to Jim Shaw, I'm sure, in some way or another. He's nipping at my heels sober, so I don't know what he would be like if I were to drink. But Jim's been a good friend in Vinoy, and I've got a lot of friends in this room, John and Matt, and a lot of people, Chuck, that I've known for quite a while, and it's always a pleasure to see old friends. I have no reason to be an alcoholic. I am just a drunk, by the way. I don't have any other issues. I think being an alcoholic is issue enough. Anything else is sort of icing on the cake, you know. That's I have no reason to be an alcoholic. It was the most annoying thing that I found when I got sober, was that I was an alcoholic. That just pissed me off, to think of all the other problems I've got, and then you try to throw that one on me. I mean, I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I've heard your stories. You're drunks, definitely. You know, if I had been like you, I would have quit also. But I'm different. I was born the only child to a carpenter and his wife out in Glendale. And I'm a native Californian. I've lived here all my life. I've had the benefit of good schools. My parents didn't have a whole lot when I was growing up. They had enough to provide me with anything that I needed. As a kid, I didn't think that was enough, of course, because my friend's parents were all cool. And then there was my dad, you know, who was out in the garage sawing wood, sawdust on his glasses, wearing those squishy-soled shoes. And the other kids' dads carried briefcases and wore suits and went off to work. And my dad's got a fifth-grade education, and he's out there providing for me, you know. And that just, I thought, oh, that's so seedy. I was thinking this way when I was 5 years old. You know, this is really like Tobacco Road around here. Everybody else seems to be so prosperous and happy and healthy, and here I am, you know, with these two parents and no brothers and sisters, and having this tremendous insight into the way things really are. And I've been plagued with that. And I've also been burdened for decades with potential. I found in sobriety people never tell successful people that they have potential. They just tell us, you know? Because if you've got potential and you're using it, then you're successful. But I choose not to use, I like to kind of keep it, you know? I like to have that as my ace up my sleeve, as my potential. Because I know as long as I'm California's best kept secret, I've got one over on you. I know I could do better, I just choose not to. It's a decision I've made. Because then when I really do it, I'm going to knock you right out of your shoes. You're going to be blinded by the kind of stuff I'm going to do once I get it in gear. It's just tomorrow. I'll get to it tomorrow. And I've had high school counselors and priests tell my parents, you know, Charles has a ton of potential. We just don't understand why he doesn't do anything. And they just didn't get it. That's been my battle cry all my life, is you just don't get it. You obviously don't have the kind of perception that I've got, where I can see the reality behind things. I know how things tick. I know how people are. I know that they're not true, and they're unkind, and they're cruel, and they, because I always felt miserable, because I was, you know, by the time I got out of high school, I was 6'2", 129 pounds of percolating testosterone, you know, just this driven. I hadn't had a drink yet. I was 17, and I was just primed, you know. I was ready, just ready. I was like that critical mass that was waiting for someone to ignite it. And I hated everything. I was a cynic. I was angry. I thought people were disgusting. I grew up in the 60s, which was the big time of peace and love, and I wanted to feel love like everybody, but I couldn't produce love. You know, it's hard to generate it, because I thought love was an emotion, and you cannot create emotions. Emotions just are. And I don't think my emotions are any different than anybody else's emotions. If you talk to anybody on the street, you'll find that everybody feels depressed. Everybody feels lonely. Everybody feels threatened by things outside their control. Everybody feels lost sometimes. Everybody feels restless, irritable, discontented. Everybody feels that way from time to time. My problem is that my emotions happen to have an unfortunate timing, you know. They have an unfortunate duration, too, and a usually inappropriate intensity. But they're no different than anybody else's. Same old emotions. And I didn't know what was wrong. I just felt this constant, all my life I felt this constant longing inside for something that I didn't know what it was. But I knew that I would know it when I found it. And if there's anything I know about alcoholics and alcoholism, is that we understand pronouns better than any group of people in the world. We know what it means. We know that if we just had it, everything would be fine. I can't tell you what it is, but I will know it. And we know who they are, because they are in the way of my getting it, you know? It's them. You know, and if you don't understand who they are, you are probably one of them. But they don't get it either. I think you're tracking me. Sometimes I wonder, I get into a group of people, you know, if you talk to non-alcoholics, they look at you like you're like ready to pull out an acetylene torch and ignite them, you know. People just didn't understand how I felt, and I didn't understand how I felt either. I just walked around miserable and wanting to be something that I was not. I always wanted to be something I wasn't. I wanted to be debonair, you know. I wanted to not care. I wanted to have women shinnying up my leg. I wanted to have... I wanted to be like Errol Flynn, you know, with that, just looking terrific and having it all down and not caring. You know, that's what I wanted to feel. I wanted to be a cutthroat, but I was a nice guy, you know. But I wanted to be a cutthroat, and I found over a period of time it's very difficult to cut someone's throat when you're busy kissing their ass, you know. It's a big reach around, I'll tell you that. And I just could not pull it off, and it's hard to give off the ode to Errol Flynn when you look like Sherman in the Mr. Peabody cartoons, you know. And but I tried. I did my best. I just looked foolish, you know. No one paid attention to me. No one. I couldn't get the attention that I wanted. I wanted to be loved, but I didn't know. Here's something that I think is purely alcoholic. I wanted to be loved, but I hated being loved. I want to be approved of, but I hate your patronizing approval. I want to be taken at my word, but I listen for the implied content of everything you say. You know, because I know what you really mean. And I lived in fear of being found, you're finding out that I really don't understand anything. And fear of people discovering what I'm afraid of. You know, and I hid behind having a, you know, this jolly boy, good sense of humor, and trying to make people laugh and throwing the joke up here and trying to make you laugh at this. Because if I can get you to laugh at this up here, you'll never look at what's going on in here, and I don't have to either. You know, as long as I got you distracted, just continually distracted, we don't have to dig into here. We don't have to look into here. And I don't have to go into the roots of my hatred. I can just pretend that I don't hate people, and I can just go along and try to be everything for everybody. And it's an exhausting thing. And I hadn't even had a drink yet. But when I was 18 years old, I just turned 18, and when I got out of high school, I got right into the music industry as a clerk at this record store in my neighborhood. And it was there that these guys who I knew from high school, who were sort of I never hung out with one crowd. I was sort of like the class dork, you know, and the reason was that I always had a grudging admiration for bad people. I kind of liked that element, you know, that tattooed element. I couldn't get a tattoo myself. We were laughing about that at dinner last night. I could get a tattoo of a goldfish and to go all the way around my arm, but I like that kind of element. People like that seem to have control, and they didn't live by other people's rules, and I like that, but I couldn't do that because I didn't want to disappoint my parents. I love my parents. I couldn't tell them that. I didn't even know it myself. But I didn't want to displease them, and they were so good to me, and they did everything they could for me, and I, you know, just, Jesus, I can't stand people's love when I don't choose to ask for it. You know, love is hard to take when it's unsolicited. It makes me uncomfortable. Now, if I want your love and you give it to me, fine. Or better yet, if I want your love and you don't give it to me, better yet. Then you get some torque going. But the minute I get it, it's like, tag, you're it, and I run. And because it scares the hell out of me when I finally do get it. It's like I've been nipping at the tires of a passing relationship for as long as I can remember. And I'm just like that dog. I don't know what I'd do if I ever caught the car. I don't know. But when I hung out with these guys, and they invited me to a party one time, and we went, and we got drunk, all of us. The first time in my life that I ever felt, you know, I talk about my childhood a little bit because it's really important to understand, for me to reiterate what I am, in order to understand the kind of relief that alcohol gave me. Because I'm an alcoholic, period. Alcohol gave me relief. That's why I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because of all the other crap I've done, the only thing that ever gave me a genuine spiritual relief was alcohol. The thing that filled that emptiness inside of me that I didn't really quite understand was alcohol. The minute I got drunk, I had a 16-ounce can of malt liquor, and I had a spiritual experience. And I don't say that to be funny. Only alcoholics understand when alcohol really starts to work for you, whether you have it like I did the first moment I started drinking, or whether you're another type of alcoholic who drinks for a period of years and then crosses the invisible line into alcoholism, when it starts to work, it is a spiritual experience. It's a false one, but it's a spiritual experience. And it's one that I am very reluctant to give up. And the cheat of alcohol for me was that over a period of years and period of 13 years of drinking, everything got worse, the drinking got worse, it got more out of control, and I held on even tighter to trying to make it work again. Because it gave me a little, even at the very last, it never stopped working, it would give me little glimpses of the way it used to be that kept me going. And it just was so frustrating. It's like trying to chase the carrot. You know, I couldn't get it. I just could not catch it anymore. And that didn't stop me from drinking. And I drank this one night, this first night, and everything that I ever felt about myself was erased. Every fear I had was relieved. Every sense of insecurity was gone. I felt unified with you. I felt true joy inside for the first time in my life. I felt joy. I'd never felt that before. As much as people had done for me and as many things as I've had going on in my life, that was the one thing I don't recall I've ever experienced by myself. And that is joy, that sense of complete and utter well-being. I was there. I was in the moment. I was with you. We were together, and we were all on the same playing field, and I was there, you know? And that's why I drank. I didn't drink to get drunk. I didn't drink to piss my pants. I didn't drink to pass out and wind up in the men's room of the Humdinger or the Shimmy Shack or any of the other, urine festivals I was going to. I drank just to get there. And only alcoholics understand where there is. You know, when I drink alcohol, I get to that place where everything is about to be all right. It never is quite all right, because if it was just all right, I could stop drinking and kind of sit there. But it's going to be all right soon, so I continue to drink, trying to find, next drink is going to get me there. No, maybe not this one, the next one, and pretty soon everything happens. You know, things start happening, consequences. And there's one thing an alcoholic hates, it's consequences. When I was young and was cute, I could drink and it was all funny. You know, an 18-year-old drunk is kind of a cute thing to other 18-year-olds. But when you're 30 and you're still trying to be that cute 18-year-old, it's pretty humiliating and ridiculous. And even 18-year-olds shun you. And I don't have a very exciting drunkalogue. I have probably the most tedious drunkalogue in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't do all the stuff you did. I did it in a minor scale. You know, when I came to AA, I was just awed by what people were saying from the podium about crashing cars. You know, I never crashed my car. Oh, once, but I would whack my car. You know, just that little drag it around a stucco wall when you're trying to make a U-turn. And I had terrible depth perception drinking. I'm one of those drunks who believes that the fastest way down a flight of stairs is to relax. Just, it's going to be all right. And that's surrender, you know. I heard about people getting 12-step by the SWAT team. I just couldn't believe it, you know. I got sober a week ago in the SWAT. I came out of a blackout, and the guy had his boot on my head with a shotgun stuffed in my mouth. And I thought, lucky you, you know. You know, I got brought here by somebody, you know. I got brought here by my sister-in-law. Quiet, honey. I love children, but my crawl space under my house is full. Go outside or Uncle Charlie's going to take you to Michael's compound. I've never been arrested, but I've been pulled over by the police all the time, drunk. You know, lots of times. Pulled over and never given a sobriety test. Of course, this is back early 70s when they weren't, you know. Now, if they see you making an illegal lane change, they'll pull you over and give you a sobriety test. But then you could get away with it. I lived in Santa Monica, which was at the time a pretty small area, and people knew each other. I worked at Santa Monica College, and I sort of knew people around the area, and I could talk my way out of things, you know. I could, and usually the police would get another call, is what would happen, and I'd get left sitting at the curb thinking, damn, you know, whew, that was lucky. And I'd go back to the bar, you know, and have another drink, you know, celebrate, relax now. You know, I've been under a lot of stress for a few moments there, but I need a drink. And all that stuff that happened to you hadn't happened to me yet. And I heard that when I was new, that if you are trying to compare your stories, you're always going to lose. There's always, if you're trying to be the baddest ass in AA, you're always going to lose, because somebody's always got a worse story. The thing is that no matter how bad or how lightweight your story is, if you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. It doesn't matter if you're 10 years old or 100 years old. If you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. It's just a matter of how willing are you to surrender, to stop drinking and to stop doing to yourself what you're going to do. Because if alcoholism is affecting your life, as it was affecting mine, I had to make a decision. I didn't make the decision willingly. I got pushed against the wall and had to make the decision. And I got married. I got married right up here at the Hope Ranch in Santa Barbara. There are a lot of ghosts in Santa Barbara for me. And My ex-wife's dad lived in Hope Ranch, and we got married in his backyard. And it was kind of funny because Tim sent this flyer with all the names of all the hotels in Santa Barbara that you could stay at to if you're coming to this conference. And the one I wound up at that Tim arranged for me to stay at was the Pepper Tree over on State Street. And I spent the night before I got married drunk at the Pepper Tree. I was carried out of Chuck's Steakhouse on someone's shoulders. What had happened was we got there, my best man and I got there, John, and he was my buddy from high school, and he was my drinking partner. And we got there, and my mother-in-law, her mother, my wife to be, and my mother all came to the door of the hotel room at about 4 that afternoon. You know, and John goes to the door, and I'm sitting inside. I'm already starting to fire him down, and we've got the things lit, if you know what I mean, and everything's going, and John answers the door, and my mother-in-law to be says, "I have one instruction for you. He is not to drink tonight. I don't want him to drink. Do you understand that?" Because her son, my brother-in-law, died of alcoholism at 25, drowned, I think, right up in this area. And she said, "I don't want him drinking tonight." And John said, "We'll take care of him." Well, you know, the door shut, you know, next party down. I wound up in a blackout that night. I woke up the next morning in that room sick as a dog. It was pitch black in the room. I thought it was still the middle of the night, and it was almost 9 o'clock, and I had to get married at 1, and I was sick, and my mother is knocking at the door. "Honey, I just want to have breakfast with my son one last time while he's still single." Oh, Jesus, you know, all 26 years, and now she chooses sentimental time. I can't believe this, you know. And I didn't like to throw up. I don't like that. It's not the vomiting is so bad, it's the aftertaste that really used to get to me. And I learned through sheer willpower, and they say we don't have willpower, we don't have willpower, we don't have self-discipline, bull, we've got it to burn. Because I learned early on how to hold a wad of vomit and balance it in my gullet like that little bubble in a carpenter's level, you know. I could hold it, just sheer dint of will. I would sit there, and I went out to breakfast with my mother, and I was hungover and sick, and I don't know where I was. I'd been brought back to the room because I'd passed out in the bathroom at Chuck's Steakhouse, and I'm sitting over breakfast with my mom, and they bring this food to the table, the smell of eggs and fried food wafting up, and it was everything I could do to just sit there and, you know, I'm thinking, "Mom, do not break my concentration. It's going to be one of those moments that you're going to remember if you do." And I married a lovely woman, you know, that day. And we had, you know, I really did believe I loved this woman. I cared about her. I was committed to her as far as a person like me could be committed. And she's not an alcoholic. And she's not an Al-Anon either, because she never went to Al-Anon. Al-Anons are people who go to Al-Anon meetings and work the 12 steps of the Al-Anon program. Al-Anons are not people who just love alcoholics. You know, if that were the case, that would mean that every drunk down in Skid Row is a member of AA, and that's not so either. But she, on our second date, I went to her house drunk after having solved the Kennedy assassination. A month later, we moved in together. You know, that should have been a warning sign for her, but she didn't listen, and it was her fault. Anyway, I'm joking. She did everything she could to help me, and that's the most tragic part of alcoholism, I think. If it had just been me destroying myself, I suppose that's sad enough to somebody walking by, but the effect that we have on other people and the effect we have in our lives on virtually every area we touch with our attitude and our actions and our things just is hideous. And she did, I had her jumping through hoops, you know, and we can do that. And we went to marriage counseling a month before we got married. That should have been a tip-off for her, too. And her therapist had urged her, she was going to therapy at the time, and her therapist had told her, "Get away from this guy. He's bad news after this Kennedy assassination thing." And, that, you know, like I said, a month later, we moved in together because she knew that it was different with me. And I thought it was different, too. There was nothing wrong with me. I just was a little drunk that night. Then the third date we had, I fell backwards in this person's house and hit my head on the windowsill at this party and had the hostess wrapping ice trays in towels because I hit so hard. The neighbors down below came upstairs to see what had happened because it made such a noise on the windowsill. And my head swelled up like a baseball on the back of it. And I didn't quit drinking, and I didn't pause, and I didn't pass out. I just kept on going, you know. And that wasn't enough of a sign for her either. And I, it was doing what I do, you know. I hurt myself. I hurt other people. I don't like doing that. Everything in my life that I did that I could see the effect it was having on other people made me feel shame and guilt and embarrassment and frustration that I just want to change so much. And I don't know how to change. I don't know what to do. But I have to change. But I can't change. And she suggested maybe I should try therapy. And one time when we were at that premarital therapy session, we were sitting there and the therapist said, Charles, is there something about you that you might want to come in and talk about on your own without Lisa here? Is there something that maybe you'd like to find out about yourself? And I said, with as much conviction as I have about Alcoholics Anonymous, I said completely straight-faced, I know everything there is to know about me. I'm fine with it. If anybody's got a problem, she does. I'm willing to work with her. And I was dead serious, you know. I say that now, and I feel horror when I say it. I feel, at the time, I really believe, I had to believe that, you know. And I was drinking at home and drinking all the time around her, and she chose not to see that. She didn't choose not to say anything about it. She would say things like, why do you have to order another drink? You just had a drink. You know, as if one is going to be enough. I hate that kind of stuff. It's like Alcohol Awareness Week, you know. I used to teach, I taught high school sober. There's some big termites around here. This Alcohol Awareness Week, when I was teaching high school, we had to do it. It's so hilarious. Awareness will not help an alcoholic because it's not me, you know. Of course I know alcohol is bad, but not for me. It feels great when I drink. I'm not one of those drunks. It makes me feel wonderful. Why would I stop? That because it might be bad for me in the long run? What are you, crazy? You know, and she would say, you've been drinking too much. And we had, you know how people have those little pet phrases when you when you're married, little pet things that you say to each other. Hers was, I'll drive, you know. And I didn't know where that came. She just always, because she said, you're going to drink and I'll drive. And that was back in the mid-70s. And I went to therapy and I found something out about therapy. Therapy's wonderful. As long as you never have to leave the office, you know. Therapy's great. If I could handcuff myself to that therapist and just go around with her all day long, having her explain to me what it is I'm feeling right now, you know, and interpreting all that stuff, that my frustrations are a sense of fear of abandonment, and that I can't commit because I have fear of surrender. And that if I knew all that stuff all day long, I'd be fine. But the minute I left that office, I'd go down onto Santa Monica Boulevard, and I need a drink. Now. Because I've been sitting there for an hour and we've been talking about all my problems. I am exhausted. I need some relief. And I'll tell you one thing, meditation doesn't work for a drinking alcoholic. You can sit in a corner wearing a pyramid hat till you turn blue in the face and it will not change you. You can sit and listen to spiritual tapes and read Scott Peck until your eyes fall out and you will not get any better. Because it's not a matter of knowledge. You know, I went to all these New Age things, or not all of them, I went to several of them before I got sober, and I'd go to these things, and New Age was great for people who can't commit. All you have to do is act like you feel it. There's no responsibility. There's no responsibility there. It's easy for non-alcoholics to do that and feel good about themselves. We just want to feel good about myself, that's all. I just want to feel all good, you know? I have a right to be happy. Bullshit. And I went to that therapist for a while, and for a couple of years, actually. I was getting insurance kickbacks from it, so I was paying her 30 and filing for 45 and making a little money, getting well and making some money on the side. You can't beat that. And of course, my wife left, and she got tired of seeing me sitting out on the porch with my headphone extensions all the way out onto the front porch in Manhattan. We lived in Manhattan Beach, and I'd sit out there on the porch and with a bottle of Jack Daniels and sit there and look at the ocean and play records and sit there and think about how tomorrow I'm going to get it all together. I'd been going to the hospital. You know, I went to the hospital for vomiting and stomach problems and going to the hospital for peeing blood, passing blood in a lot of different places that you don't normally expect it. It's like, whoa, what's that? And just another childhood illness creeping up on me, I guess. And I had all these illnesses. I've carried this thing around in my wallet. This is from my doctor so that I could get insurance money for therapy. It said, please, Mr. Carney is in need of psychotherapy for situational problems. Situational problems. Perfect. I'm not an alcoholic. I got situational problems. If the situations would get better, I wouldn't have a problem. It's not me. Look at this world we live in. I'd started saving food up for Armageddon. At my house, by this time I'd moved back into my mother's house down in Orange County, and I was living in Anaheim in this three-bedroom house with about a half a room full of furniture in it, and my mom had remarried and was living down in Huntington Beach, and I'm living in this house, and I'm supposed to pay her house payment. She said, oh, honey, move in here. You don't have to pay rent. You can just pay the house payment. It was $120 a month. I was almost 4 months behind. They were threatening to take the house away because $120 a month is a lot of scratch to pull together when you're drinking, you know? And I had no money. I'd spent all my money. I'd spent all of my wife's money on her credit card that I still had that she was responsible for. And I had all this, I had closets full of food, canned food, Sterno stuff. I wore sunglasses indoors at night because it was cool, you know. I was about 35 pounds heavier than I am now, just kind of bloated because when I stopped drinking, I dropped the weight off in about 3 months. I was down to 170 pounds, but I was just blah. And I was sitting in that house. I'd sit in that house with a bottle of whiskey, and I'd sit there and drink and look out the window and think about what was going to happen, where I was going to go. My wife had helped put me through college, and I had a degree in journalism, and I was getting into the writing profession. I was a receiving clerk at this bookstore at Santa Monica College for years, and I had all these dreams, you know, and all these dreams were fortified over and over again by alcohol. Alcohol gave me the satisfaction of a job well done without ever having to do a goddamn thing. When I drank, my potential was fulfilling itself as I sat there. You know, I tried drugs, whoop-de-doo, you know. Drugs got me high. That probably shouldn't surprise anybody. Except when you consider I didn't want to be high. I wanted to be there. I don't want to be loaded. I want to be there. I want to be there, you know, that place. I don't want to just be staggering around. I you know, smoke marijuana and sit there loaded, you know, till 3 o'clock in the morning. And I mean, in the kitchen eating a jar of mayonnaise. You know, just, I took speed because I thought it would help me focus at work, and it did. I was busy, and, but again, I just got busy. I didn't get there. All I had was the sensation of my eyes trying to beat me into the next room, you know. And I smoked PCP. Now there's a wonderful drug. I realized something with drugs, too, that as an alcoholic, I don't need to induce psychosis. I hear drug addicts say, I took drugs to get away from the world. I took alcohol to get in the world. I thought that was my entry-level access. I need to be drunk to feel things that other people feel. Otherwise, I just button it up, suck it in, and smile, and die inside. You know, I'm one of those guys who smiles and dies. I'm one of those guys who stands at the corner of the meeting, off in the back, and stands there with his arms folded and doesn't talk to anybody because I am dying inside. And what I didn't understand how to do that. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I just knew they'd disappoint me. I hated everybody. I hated everything. I was a solitary drinker at the end, the last couple of terrible years, and I went on a meditation retreat to try to get some help, and right up in Montecito. And I went there one Friday night, and the next day, after I hadn't had a drink for 24 hours, something happened to me, and something that has changed my life forever. And that was, I had a tap on the shoulder, you know. I think everybody here has had it. Might be some red and blue lights in your rearview mirror. It might be the look of somebody in your family. It might be a close call. With me, it was sitting up at this meditation retreat and wanting to die, and sitting out there feeling like, I have nothing, there is absolutely nowhere else I can go. My wife has left me, I have no money, I have no friends, really. I had friends, people wanted to be my friend, I just could not sustain a friendship. It's just so much trouble because they don't understand. And I had no relationship with my mom. My father had died years before, and I had never really had a real relationship with him. And I had all this talent that I thought, I had all this potential, and I could not get anything together. And I sat up at this retreat, and I realized at that moment that I was going to live with this kind of despair and this kind of pain and this kind of fear for the rest of my life. I would live this way for the next 40 years. And I could drink, but drinking doesn't even do anything for me anymore. But I still drink. And I know I'm going to go home from this meditation retreat tonight, and I'm going to drink again. And I'm going to be in the same boat that I was to last Sunday, watching the sun go down and sitting there and believing that everybody in the world is in a place with someone they love, and I'm the only one who feels this way. And I'm alone, and all the hope that was in the air on Friday night is now just a memory. It's gone, and so is all my money. You know, and everything I had was gone. And I would live these weeks over and over like that, like Groundhog's Day, you know, endless repetition of the same feeling and the same week and the same actions and the same results and the same frustration and the same disappointment and the same fear and the same inability to connect with anything or anybody. And God damn it, I want out. I want to die. I don't want to have any grand suicide. I just want this to stop. I've already blown off my life. I'm almost 31 years old, and I thought, this is it. You know, I can't, it's not going to change. It is never going to change. And I wanted to die. And at that very moment that I felt so empty, and you know, it had gone beyond self-pity. If it had just been self-pity, I could have gotten some gratification just from that. Self-pity is sort of, it comes back with compound interest. You know, you kind of get some joy out of self-pity. There was no self-pity here. It was just despair. That endless despair that kills alcoholics. And I sat there and I felt empty and alone, and I got a moment of feeling absolutely loved. I don't know where that came from. At the time, I didn't understand it. I felt loved all the way down inside, and it just shook me like an earthquake. I sat there and I just started sobbing because I didn't know what the hell is happening to me. How can I feel love, this feeling, this absolute feeling of joy inside? Die, on the other hand, too. And I realized later on, I didn't realize it for years later. I'd read Bill's story, and I read right past it, you know. I read right past this stuff. I just knew that it scared me enough to make me do something. But at the time, I didn't realize that what I got at that moment is something that every alcoholic gets. And that's a glimpse, first of all, of everything I really am. And the fact that I have a creator who deeply cares about me, you know, as his child and his creation. And I got a little, because if I were to look at, I've gotten little glimpses of God over the last 12 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, little glimpses of him, you know. It's like God could not show himself to us because we'd go blind. You know, it says that in all kinds of, in various religions, it tells you that God will never show himself to us because we couldn't bear to see it. We couldn't bear to see it. But he gave me at that day a little glimpse of himself and said, I'm right here, and then left. And I felt love just from that little glimpse, and I didn't know what it was, but it was certainly enough to pique me, you know, just to get me going. And God is always around the corner for me, going, I'm over here, and then gone. I go trotting over, and nope, not there, over here. I go trotting over that way, you know. As long as I'm willing to surrender, I'll follow where the indicators are. But this week, I didn't know what to do. I got this feeling, and I sat there and just wept the whole afternoon up at this Montecito Retreat Center. And I went home the next day, and I stopped at the store, and instead of buying a bottle of whiskey, because I knew I had a half a bottle of Jack Daniels at home, I bought a couple of boxes of popsicles. And I went home and I sat on the front porch and I ate popsicles all night and I shook it out for about 3 days. I went to work, you know, I was a good little soldier, and I went to work and I sat there just, you know, a mess. I would fall, my boss would come in to talk to me and I would sit there and listen to her and I'd go right to sleep, right on my desk, 10 o'clock in the morning, put my head down and go sound asleep while she was talking to me. I would trip in the middle of an empty room, you know, I would walk through the school, through the campus, and I would forget how to walk. You know, just all of a sudden, I can't walk anymore. Oh no, what's happening? I can't remember how to walk. I mean, I forget how to walk. I have to literally go left foot forward, right foot next, left foot until I could remember. Oh, that's it. Okay, I can walk now. And I went through this panic and this fear all of a sudden. And I wasn't going to drink, and I toughed it out. I toughed it out for 4 days. And meanwhile, eating popsicles and puking up these melted rainbows. And my sister-in-law, my wife's brother's former wife, had gotten out of a care unit in Orange, and she invited me to take her to an AA meeting. And she knew how I drank, and she 12-stepped me. I told her that I'd stop drinking, and she, you know, how, that's all you got to say to us. You know, that's like what Grace was saying. I mean, Katie was saying last night is that you just have to say it to an alcoholic I don't know if I have a drinking problem or not. And phew, up go the antennas, and we just meow right in. And she had 22 days sober, and she 12-stepped me. And if you think that you don't have enough time to work with another alcoholic, I owe my life to somebody with 22 days sober. You know, she brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. She brought me here and left me here, because 10 days later she went out and got drunk again. You know, and I got left here, and I was mad. Because she was the only person I knew. Because I was standing in the corner of the room. And you guys would come trotting back there, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, nice to meet you. Are you new? And I thought, nope, I'm a visitor. I'm here just to check out the lay of the land. I'm not here to really, I'm not an alcoholic, you see. I've still got that ember of potential that I just need to fan and get it going again. You, obviously, I hate to judge, but this is really the biggest loserama I've ever seen in my life. But I still have some potential in there that I'm going to set on fire later on. I'm just cooling my heels for a while, and I'm not drinking. You know? I didn't say that in so many words. I said, no, I'm new. And the people were kind to me, and I came back. You know, I kept coming back. And there were two guys one afternoon. Well, it was a 7:30 at night meeting. I got there at 4 to get a good seat. And it was a Sunday afternoon, and I knew what was coming. Sundown was coming. And it's like, get me to my casket full of soil from my native land before the sun goes down. And I trotted to this AA meeting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I didn't know if anybody was going to be there. It was at a civic center in Tustin. And I got there, and there were two guys there who happened to be there dropping off coffee pots to make coffee. They happened to be there at 4. They weren't accustomed to getting there that early. And this guy named Doc and this other guy named Frank, I'll never forget these guys. And I haven't seen them since I stopped going to that meeting. I wound up going up to the Pacific Group meeting. But they sat there and talked to me. They had me set up chairs. And they taught me something, first of all, about sobriety. The very first thing I learned about sobriety is that you don't have to be sincere to stay sober. You just have to do something. You don't have to feel good about doing it. Because, as my sponsor so delicately told me, no one gives a rat's ass how you feel about anything, newcomer. Your feelings don't add up to anything now, do they? Because you got here on your feelings. Why don't you try just doing the actions and see what happens? And I was fortunate enough, these two guys had me setting up chairs. And I didn't want to be at the meeting, but since they were, I just didn't want to tell them no, because I'm a kiss ass. So I went and sat up the chairs. I didn't want to do it. I did it anyway. I didn't do it joyfully. Uh-oh, someone's dating an Al-Anon. I did not want to set up the chairs, but I did so, and I found out something. When they say that your defects of character, your worst defects, will become your strong points, they're not kidding. I sat up those chairs, and I went out for a donut with these guys and came back later, and they were making the coffee, and people started moving the chairs around. I set those chairs up. Maybe you don't get it, but you see, if I had wanted that chair moved over there and blocking the aisle, I probably would have put it over there because I set up the chairs. Now maybe you can just pick that goddamn chair up and move it back where it belongs, where the person who set it up put it. What I had done unconsciously was that I had just taken ownership of that meeting. It was now my chairs. And I came back the next week to make sure those chairs got set up the right way again. And I started doing things in AA, not believing anything. You know, we talk a lot about spirituality, and Sunday morning is supposed to be the spiritual speaker, which has never been an adjective that's been attached to me. But the simplicity of this program just throws people like me for a loop. You don't have to, if you're new, I got to tell you something. You don't have to find God in AA. You only have to act like you found God. And then something will happen to you. You don't have to believe in God. You just have to take actions as if you believe in God. Your belief will come later. It doesn't work that way in therapy. For me, it didn't. You know, I had to have the feelings all in order before I could take any action. I had to feel. Where do I cash out? I don't know. I got to have something tangible. And they didn't talk about surrender in my group. I heard the Pacific group was not a spiritual group. I had a guy come up to me a couple of weeks ago and say, is it a custom in this group to not talk about the steps from the podium? I said, I don't understand what you mean. Well, no one up there, there have been three speakers up there tonight, and not one of them has mentioned the steps. You know, and there seems to be a real feeling about that going around AA now, that somehow you have to do the steps as if you were, you know, conducting an IRS audit, you know. We're just workshopped to death. If you want an AA workshop, come down to the Ventura Freeway on Wednesday morning at about 8:30 and sit in your car on the freeway, and there's your best Alcoholics Anonymous workshop right there, because it's you and God and Skippy in his BMW weaving in and out of the lanes without signaling in front of you. Now you'll find out how well this program works or doesn't work, depending on what your spiritual condition is. Not by sitting down and writing out a list of all of your feelings. You know, there's only two places in the big book where it says we have to write anything, and that's writing about our inventory and writing an eighth step. And there's nothing else about sitting down and writing about God. It's far more spiritual for me to signal a lane change when it's inconvenient, just out of courtesy to another human being in the next lane. It's far more spiritual to flip on my signal and let them know I intend to move into their lane or intend to make a turn than it is to come up here and talk about God, because anybody can be a podium saint, you know. It's easy. We're expert bullshitters, really. You don't have to study the steps. You have to take them, you know. We get so mysterious about these steps, as if there's some kind of mystical thing in this book. I majored in literature in college, and I got a hold of this big book and looked at it and thought, oh, God, this is preposterous. I've taken apart John Donne poems. And here I'm reading these things about the jaywalker metaphor, you know, the King Alcohol and his mad realm. You know, this ain't Milton, folks. This is Bill and Bob. This book is written in a most direct way. Here are some suggestions of things we did. There's no mysticism. You don't need to sit down and look up in an Oxford English Dictionary the word suggestion to find out all the implications of that word. Just goddamn do it. You may mess up in the middle of doing it. I tried making amends to my wife before I'd even taken my third step. But I knew I was right. My sponsor said, don't do it. You're sweeping up your side of the street, but first of all, you got to know what side of the street you're on. And secondly, you probably will need a broom to sweep it with, and you don't have either. Don't do it. And I did it anyway. And she sat there and sobbed and wanted to get back together again. And I just had the wrong, everything was wrong. You know, I just did it wrong. And I went back to him, and I was frustrated and upset. And he said, you got to do it the way it is. Just go to your meetings. Just go to meetings every night. Get commitments at your meetings. The most spiritual thing you will ever know, the most spiritual advice I ever got or spiritual direction I ever got in Alcoholics Anonymous is be where you say you are going to be when you are expected to be there. And don't sit around trying to rationalize why you're not doing the things you're supposed to be doing. Because that'll get you. Anything you have to defend is going to get you. You know, that's what surrender is all about. Surrender is doing something, and if it works out wrong, admitting it and moving on and trying to get some feedback from people in AA and some direction to do it right, to meditate, to pray for some kind of an insight to do something and to be of service, you know. Love, I always thought, was an emotion, you know. I grew up in the love generation where you're supposed to just manufacture love. You manufacture it like some kind of a hormone. It's not. Love is nothing like that. I found that out over a period of years trying to... I thought when they said love your enemies that you were supposed to like them. You don't have to like someone to love them. You don't have to approve of them to love them. You merely have to wish them well and be of service if they need you. You know, there's nothing emotional about that. I've heard all my life that in order to love somebody else, Charles, you have to love yourself first. And that's utter bullshit. You are never, I guarantee you, I'm speaking from experience, you will never be able to love yourself until you learn to love somebody else first. Blindly. That is surrender. Is doing something you don't believe in and doing something that you don't necessarily feel like it's going to be to your benefit and doing it anyway because someone tells you that it might help. And then you find out what the emotion is afterwards. You find out where God brings his grace to you, and that's in your heart. We are the most unlovable, in our natural state, we're the most unlovable human beings on the face of the earth. Alcoholics are. We're miserable. We stink. We lie. We use. And we destroy other people around us. That is not a level, those are not qualities to shoot for, you know. And yet, the only ones who love us are Al-Anons, you know. There's a whole different side of alcoholism there, because most people just tell us to shove off and walk away. They don't feel any need to help us. Why should they? They have no need to help us. There's no moral obligation to help an alcoholic. But as an alcoholic, I have a moral obligation and a spiritual obligation to be useful to God, because I've been given sobriety freely, and it is my obligation to share it with other people or lose it. And I agree with what Katie and Vinoy and Ken said over the weekend, that, you know, this is a program purely of being of service to each other. You know, we come here and we just do what we can. Sometimes being of service is just being in the meeting. I can't tell you, there are a number of guys in my group right now who I love deeply in a way that I would, and I'm sure the love is around this room too, that there is no one in my group that I would not pick up the phone for at 3 o'clock in the morning and go meet them somewhere if they need to talk about something. I would not necessarily like getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and doing that, but there is no one that I would not do that for, because my sobriety is tied in with that. And every time I've had to do something like that, I found something on the other side of it that I would never have found on my own. And that's what God's grace is all about. It's just doing the deal. And not doing the deal as I pick and choose. It's doing the package. When my sponsor told me that I do not turn down an AA request, he means exactly that. That the word no is not part of your operating vocabulary in this program. Your operative word is yes, when. You know, that's the operating word. You show up when you say you're going to be there, you know, and you do what you're supposed to do without question. And that sounds a little Nazi to me. It sounds like I'm losing my individuality. Oh my God, I'm surrendering the wonderful person that I was before I got here to someone else's suggestions. And what's happened is I found out the real person that I am. I've managed to shear away all the distractions of my own ego, or not all of them. I mean, this happens on a daily basis. I have the devices to pull away those things. And if I can't pull them away myself, I have people like Jim and my sponsor and other people in my group who will pull them away for me. You know, we're not in the hug business here. This isn't an herbal life convention. We're not working the course on miracles here. We're not here to feel good. We're here to be of service. Period. We're in the rug pulling business. You know? Someone said the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. And that's absolutely true. Every time somebody in my group has told me the truth, I have been shocked and angry and hurt and even walked away. And then it sinks in that they're right, and I hate that. But I learned that way, and I've been lucky not to have to drink over that. On a day-to-day basis, you know, I took my inventory. I was telling about the guy who said that they don't talk about the steps in my group, which is kind of funny because I asked him, did the woman who spoke talk about getting sober? Yeah. Did she talk about surrendering to the group and to God and trying to be get rid of her defects of character by taking an inventory? She talked about reading an inventory to her sponsor and talked about working with newcomers and talked about making amends to her family and trying to get back together with her family and making amends to her ex-husbands and all this stuff. And she's here. She flew in from Minnesota to talk at a Wednesday night meeting, a regular old AA meeting, you know. And yet the guy didn't see that she was talking about the steps, you know. And that's sort of one of those weird things that's going on in AA now, that we live the steps. We don't get up and talk about. I mean, the way God will get into your heart and your soul is maybe different from the way he got into mine. I'm not, you know, you don't have to do it the way I did it. Maybe something I say will be helpful to you. Like what people have said to me all these years and people this weekend. And, you know, God gets to us on our own time and in his own time and in our own way, in the way that we're able to get him. The thing is, and Clancy says this all the time, is that the main thing a sponsor does and the rest of us do is keep the newcomer amused until God can get to him. You know? And he will. You stay sober a day at a time and make yourself of service, and I guarantee you that someday you'll find, like I did, one moment standing in Ohio Street Clubhouse mopping the floor on a commitment that I had. I looked around that room, and I looked at the people in that room, and I felt like love was just a fondness and awareness that I knew everybody standing in that line, and I liked them. I just liked them. I didn't judge them or anything. I just felt surrendered to them. Even the ones I don't like, I like them. I can't think, and some, we were talking about this, you know, how sometimes you get in conversations with your fellows, and we got one of those games, like, who do you really not like in the group? And I'll tell you the honest to God truth, I could not think of anybody that I don't like in that group, that I would avoid or shun in there. I just like people in AA. And if I can like the sickest of the sick, which is you, why can I not get in my car and drive out there and treat everybody with the same kind of respect and service that I do in here? This is just a place where I stop off and get recharged from you, because I learn from you, and you brush up against me, and you brush all that old paint off, you know, and it hurts sometimes. Try sanding a board that's got paint on it. It looks ugly as hell for a while. Then eventually the grain starts to show through, and there's beauty there. And that's what happens to you. If you're new, you're covered with paint. You're covered with, you know, you've been painting that condemned building over and over again for years. Stop painting. You get in here and let us rub up against you. And eventually your grain is going to come through. And it works. Just a short story, and I'll sit down. I went skiing a few years ago with my girlfriend, and she's a great skier. I heard someone refer to it as the devil's asshole skiers. You know, they have those triple black diamond, death-defying lateral runs down the side of a high-rise things. And I thought, yeah, I'll go out and learn how to ski. We went to Vail, Colorado, and I got on the Bunny Hill. That's where they send new skiers, you know. And I got out there, and I hated it. And I want to be on the Bunny Hill. I want to be up there, rip and run. I want to see snow blowing in my face and go by and have my teeth glistening in the wind and do it, you know. And she's out there skiing with, you know, Otto, her Bavarian ski instructor, and I'm on the bunny hill learning how to, now we're going to learn how to get up. I don't like it when the first lesson is how to get up. That implies that you are going to fall down. It's like the second step of AA, that you're going to be restored to sanity. Wait a minute. What do you mean restored? I'm as sane as the next guy in here. And we got on the bunny hill, and I learned how to do that. I went out and I started skiing, you know, over a period of hours. They take us out on the hill, and we start skiing down. I kept falling down. Fall down and fall down and fall down. I couldn't understand. I get so frustrated and tired and exhausted. By noon, I go up to the lodge where they're having lunch, and I'm sitting up there, and Maria comes walking in. How did it go? I said, horrible. What's wrong? I keep falling down. Why? I don't know. Every time I start going, I start moving, I start making my turn. My first turn, it starts going faster, and I slip and fall down. And she said, boy, that didn't sound right. I'll go out and ski with you this afternoon. I'll give you a private lesson, and we'll see what's happening. So she takes me out on the hill, and I get up there, and she goes, okay, you go up to the top of the hill, and you ski down to me, and I will watch and see what's going on. So I go up there, and she's at the bottom of the hill, and I start skiing, and I make the first turn, and I come around, and I'm starting to go faster, and I make the second turn, and I fall down. I get up. I look down, see what I mean? She says, just keep skiing. I get up, start making I move, and I'm going faster. I make the turn, come around, I start skiing faster. I'm going faster. I fall down again. I said, damn it. Well, I fell about 10 times going down this hill, and I got to the bottom, and I'm angry, and I'm wet, frustrated. I said, you see? You see what happens? I keep falling down. She said, no, you're sitting down. I said, no, I'm not. I'm falling down. And she said, no, every time you start to go a little faster, I can see it in your face. You get scared, and you lean back, and you fall down. I said, I do not. When you start going fast, your natural reaction is to lean back, you know, and get, you know, lean away from it, and I fall. She said, no, you lean back, and you sit, because it's safer than falling forward. I said, well, what do you suggest I do? And she said, lean forward when you feel like you're going to fall. I said, you're out of your ever-loving mind. I'm ripping down the hill. I'm going to fall. Lean forward. Oh, yeah, that's smart. That's like skidding out of control toward the cliff and having somebody go, floor it! Floor it! I said, that's not the problem. She said, well, solve it yourself. I'll see you. And she skied off, you know? So I took lessons the next day. I kept falling down again. And then we went out that afternoon, and her dad and her mom and her sister, and they're all like black dog skiers are up there. You know, they got the gear and all that jazz. And we're up there, and she said, I want you to come ski with us. We go up to the top of the mountain, which is, you know, they're pumping oxygen up there. And there's no sound but the wind in the trees up there. And she said, now we're going to ski down, and we'll ski as slow as you need. We're going to just make a leisurely ski down the hill. All right, so they all took off because there were snow plows coming over the hill. Let's go. They all took off. Well, I didn't want to just take off. I needed to get ready and prepare. But the snow plows are coming, and I thought, there are like eight of them, and I thought, I'm going to lose them, and I'll never find my way down. So I took off too. Halfway out, I thought, oh, shit, what have I done? I'm moving. I'm cooking. I'm moving fast. I make my first turn and whip around, and I'm hauling now. And I make my second turn. I start to go. I start getting scared. I'm going to lean back. And I thought, no. I leaned forward, and I stayed on my feet. I made the next turn, came around. I started to get nervous, and I got scared, and I leaned forward, bent my knees and leaned forward, and I stayed up. And I came around again, and I was going down, and I was making these turns. And every time I'd start to get scared and go back, I'd lean forward, and I stayed on my feet. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, I'm doing it. I am doing it. And then I ate it big time. Windmill skis going around. Hat, glasses, gloves, everything off. Some guy went by and yelled, yard sale. And I think it was the Bavarian instructor. But I'm laying there in the snow. I can't see because there's snow on my eyes because I hit really hard. And Maria took her skis off and she came running up that hill and she's going, you fell! You really fell! It was great! We're looking up going, woo, he fell! There was snow and skis and stuff going everywhere. You were leaning forward, weren't you? And I said, I was, you know? And lest you think that there's no lesson in this, I suggest for you people who are new, we all know how you feel. We don't try to understand how you feel. We know how you feel. There is no distance between sober drunks. We know it. And you're going to be scared, and you're going to feel like it's not going to work, and you're going to feel like the drink is stronger than anything else that can keep you here. But I ask you, when you start to get that way, to lean into this program. Lean forward. Come back. Join us. Call somebody. Just pick up the phone and make that call. Sometimes that is the heaviest thing in the world, is that receiver. But you got to call somebody. And I guarantee, if you do it, that you're probably going to eat it big time at some point or another. But not so much that you're not going to be able to get up and have the rest of us take our skis off and run up the hill, pick you up and dust you off, and show you how to get back on your feet one more time and keep moving sober. And I'm grateful that Tim asked me to speak, and thank you, and I'll see you later. Bye-bye.